What's up, everybody? It's Megan here and Sim today on the Financial Friday podcast episode of Student Loan Planner. Thanks, Sim, for hopping on with me today. We're going to talk about top five wealth killers in America, right?
One of my favorite topics is the things that destroy wealth and how we can prevent that.
Right. I think this is a pretty popular series, or like, I think there's a couple other like videos out there talking about wealth killers. I think we're going to put our spin on it, our flavor on it, because we see maybe a lot of different things compared to like some other kind of traditional financial planning firms. We work with a lot of folks who have student loans, obviously, and a lot of folks who are kind of in the earlier stages of their financial planning journey. So I'm curious, you know, we'll see as we go through these things, if we've got some similar wealth killers as what else is out there on the interwebs.
I think it's important to note, too, that this is not just for like low income people. This can happen to anybody. Like, doesn't matter what your income is. These are things that like anybody can do or fall into.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess the saying is like money can't really buy happiness. That's not necessarily what I'm saying, but having a lot more money doesn't mean that you're never going to have to worry about money again. Like if we don't have the right money habits in place and like the right foundation of a financial plan and behaviorally we're not in a good place with our money, like any of these things could be traps for even the wealthiest folks. Let's jump in. We've got five wealth killers to chat about. I think the first one on the list, I put this one first, credit card debt, because it's kind of like the lowest hanging fruit. Like credit cards are a wealth killer. Why do you think that is, Sim?
I think it's so easy just to swipe the card and forget about it, or to assume like, well, I have this line of credit, I can just use it. It's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. So you're not necessarily like accountable if you're not paying attention to what you're spending. I'm a big fan of credit cards. I think they can be used strategically. I think that you can, you know, get your points and get your miles and use that to build your wealth. But yeah, if you're like not looking at it, or if you're spending money you don't have, you're like, well, I don't really have this in the bank, I'm just going to put it on my credit card. Well, you're kind of just borrowing against yourself in the future.
Yeah. I mean, statistics are very interesting when it comes to credit card debt. I was looking at the most recent statistics from the Fed and from a couple different resources. But first quarter of 2024, there was $1.12 trillion outstanding credit card debt, trillion with a T. Pretty fascinating, right? Like that's a big number. According to TransUnion, which is one of the three credit reporting companies, the average credit card balance per customer rose from $5,733 in the first quarter of 2023. It rose to $6,218 in the first quarter of 2024, which probably makes sense, you know, with the holidays being at the end of the year, travel, gifts, that kind of thing. So I could see why average balances might definitely increase around the beginning part of the year. But that's a lot, you know, per month. I was doing the math on like what interest would cost on a balance of about $6,200. And the average interest rate, by the way, is 22.63%. And that was back as of February 2024, which I've seen some that are 29.99%.
I was going to say 22 seems like on the low end. I see a lot around 28, 29 with my clients.
Yes. And it's actually really hard to find your interest rate. You have to look at your statement, which a lot of us don't look at our statements anymore. We just have the app where we could see like what we owe, what we have to pay, the due date. They make it really simple. But if you open up and actually look at the statement in your document section, you have to kind of scroll down to multiple pages down below your transactions, and then it'll show you what your interest rate is. And the interest rate changes, by the way. Like, I don't know if everybody knows that, but with credit cards, interest rates change based on the market. And so what it was, you know, 2 years ago when you opened the card might not be the case now. So average 22.63%, that's high. Actually, I did the math for the average balance for millennials, which the average balance for millennials was $6,521 credit card balance. So if we're paying interest on that, that's about $122 a month for a millennial right there, which that might not seem like a lot, but that's $122 you're paying the bank. Or like paying kind of like a premium for whatever you already spent money on. When you're making payments towards the credit card, like it's going to make it feel like you're not making as much progress because so much of that payment goes towards the interest cost. But what did you think about the breakdown of like average credit card balances by generations?
Yeah, I was just looking at them. Like, this is so interesting. So Gen Z youngest generation, and then silent generation, oldest generation, are both like on the lower end of like how much credit card debt they have. Gen X has the highest with like 9,000, over 9,000. So almost three times as much as the other two. For the silent generation, I think that's a little bit more self-explanatory. I think this is an older generation that maybe isn't necessarily as tech savvy. They're used to paying cash for certain things. And plus, they also have a lot more wealth than the other groups. And so they are probably less likely to run up debt. Gen Z is interesting. And I can guess that it's probably because of the rise of these different apps that people use to pay for things. So like Cash App or Venmo that are attached to your bank account. So you're basically paying cash. It's a digital way of paying cash. And so if you're doing that, you're less likely to put things on your credit card. That's my best guess. What do you think, Megan?
Yeah, hopefully it's just maybe they've had access to things like YouTube or things like even TikTok or like Instagram Reels that has a little more education around money. Maybe this is like the most optimistic way to think about it. Like maybe they're learning a little faster than the rest of our generations about money because of the access.
Think too that like a lot of them were born around like 1999 or 2000. And so these are people who are like 8 or 9 years old when the financial crisis happened in 2008. That's probably very salient. Like they probably remember their parents struggling during that time. A lot of people lost their jobs, lost a lot of assets in their retirement accounts. So I think they also could have internalized, like, I don't want to be in that situation.
That's true. That's a good point. You know, that makes sense behaviorally because so my great grandmother was alive during the Great Depression. She lived until her very late 90s, recently passed. She lived a really great life, but she lived through the Great Depression, or her parents definitely did. They were adults, right, when that was going on. But she carried with her like behaviors from that. Even though she was a really young girl, she carried behaviors from that where she never threw anything away. Like it was used until it was falling apart. So like all her shoes, they were literally tearing at the soles before she would go and replace them or get a different shoe. She also, kind of on the reverse side of things, her pantry was always stocked to the brim with food. Because they had such a food crisis back then in the Great Depression, where like they weren't able to get access to food. So she always, to feel secure, had food on hand, which she also gave to my grandmother. So this is my great grandmother. She passed to my grandmother. So my grandma's the same. My mom is the total opposite. It's kind of funny. She's like me. Like we're pretty scarce with groceries. We go when we have to.
That's so funny. I actually kind of grew up similarly, Megan. My grandma grew up during the Ukraine famine. And so it was all about food, you know, food being a resource. And so growing up in her house, because she basically raised me, it's like you had to eat everything on your plate. You couldn't waste like anything. She would tell the story. And at first when I was young, I thought she's being dramatic. I realized, no, this is actually what happened. How like her and her cousins were like huddled over a piece of bread. And they were like so thankful to God they had this piece of bread. And so growing up, I had like a weird relationship too, where like, I knew I was eating past the point where like I didn't want to eat anymore. So like I have a better relationship with that now. But even now, I always make sure that my pantry is stocked. I'm like, is everyone full? Like if I have guests over, is anyone hungry? Like total like Jewish grandma. Is everyone eating? Yeah, these are the things that you kind of grow up with. It's a generational trauma in a way.
Yeah. With credit cards, like everybody knows that we shouldn't have credit card debt, right? Like we know we have to get out of it as soon as possible if we have it, and to avoid it like the plague, because it really is a wealth killer and how much interest it costs you. And there's so many misconceptions about credit card debt too. Like people will say, well, I have to carry a balance to make sure my credit is good. That's not true. You don't have to carry a balance and pay interest on the balance to maintain good credit. You just have to have on time in full monthly payments. You can pay the whole balance off every month to avoid that interest cost. And you're going to maintain good credit that way. Really, the debt to income ratio is what can really kill like your credit score, because if you've got a lot on the card compared to your available credit, your utilization rate looks bad. Like the credit card companies and like TransUnion, for example, they're looking at you and they're thinking like, dang, they're using a lot of their available credit. That's kind of risky. They must need it.
I think an honorable mention with the credit cards, what causes a lot of credit card debt, in addition to like, you know, behavior and whatnot, is rising healthcare costs. Healthcare is very expensive. Even just health insurance is very expensive. I pulled up an average online for those who are on a one-person plan on an ACA plan is about $477 a month if they're not getting any tax credits. Very expensive. And then it gets even worse if you're like in my situation, we had to be on COBRA for a couple of months because my husband was changing jobs. Family of four, we were paying like high 700s, which is already bad. That's already very like painful, right? Then we went on Cobra. It was almost, I kid you not, $2,500 a month just to keep the same coverage. And it's just, at that point, you're almost like, do I just like roll the dice? Am I really going to like have a catastrophe? But like with two small kids, we're like, yeah, we'll just do it. But these are expenses where if you have, and that's just the premiums, that's not even including like copays, deductibles, max out of pocket. Where does that go for someone who doesn't have an emergency fund? It's going to end up on your credit card.
Yeah. So the first line of defense against credit card debt, against this wealth killer, is emergency savings. Like, we literally cannot stress emergency savings enough. It's the most boring topic. It's money sitting in savings, hopefully a high yield savings account, right? Like earning interest, but it will save you because credit card debt is worse than boring savings. Have about 3 to 6 months of necessary living expenses on hand. That's a good rule of thumb that can help prevent credit card debt if something unexpected comes up, or maybe income is impacted, or inflation, right? If we're getting adjusted to inflation, don't let credit card debt be something that kills your ability to grow wealth as fast as you can. Next up, let's talk about cars.
Oh gosh, I feel like I was just talking about cars the other day with someone. We were talking about like Teslas and mom minivans.
Mm-hmm. So cars, I would consider as another wealth killer. Most people do need transportation, right? Unless you live in a very large metropolitan area, like New York City, for example, LA, you have to have a car, right? So like New York, maybe Chicago, you could probably get away with like one car. But for a lot of cities, most cities, you require a car for transportation. So we have to drive one, but how can we prevent it from being a wealth killer? Well, some quick stats and we'll get into it. So auto balances hit $1.62 trillion in Q1 of 2024. So that's actually higher than the credit card debt balance from what we just talked about. Credit card debt balance was at $1.12 trillion. Average car balances hit $1.62, which it's now the second largest debt category behind mortgages. We're not talking about student loans yet because student loans are higher than these numbers.
I know. I'm like putting a pin in it. I'm like, but wait, there's more.
Interestingly, Texas has the highest car loan balance. The average is 7,810. Averages are dangerous, right? There's some really low car balances, but there's also some really high car balances. My theory for Texas, tell me if you think this is a good theory or not, is all those big trucks out there.
I was thinking it's the trucks plus everything is really spread out.
Yeah. That's true. Texas is massive too. Like Texas is a huge state and
yeah,
probably everyone in Texas needs a car for transportation. Like even if you live in Austin or Dallas, like you need a car for transportation, I would think. So pretty interesting. That means the average car payment for new cars is about $738 a month. For used cars, it's a little less, $532 a month, according to Experian. The average new car costs an average of about $48,000, according to Cox Automotive. And average loan term, this was kind of interesting, was 67, almost 68 months. So longer than 5 years, which car loans used to standardly be like no more than 5 years, right? Do you remember when that was the case?
Yeah. And you can get them like as high as 7 now, I've been seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think 7 is currently the highest. I hesitate because I think I saw an 8-year term. I can't remember where or what bank, but I thought I saw an 8-year term.
You think that we'll ever see them as long as mortgages? We'll see like a 15-year and a 30-year. Can you imagine all those interest costs?
Gosh, I really hope not. I hope not. Because the average loan rate right now for a car is not super cheap. It's 7.18%, which is cheaper than credit card debt, but 7.18% is pretty high. Like when we're talking about debt, but from a financial planning perspective, like when we think about debt and interest rates and prioritizing what we should be like taking care of in a financial plan, like we look at the interest rate one. And if the interest rate is kind of in a gray area or over what we think we can make investing long term, that's a debt that we should be paying down sooner rather than later. Because if we were to take that extra money and invest it, we might not be able to catch up to what that debt is costing you. And 7.18 is gray area, kind of in that higher range where if we had a dollar to invest or to pay down the car, like, I don't know, I'd probably say the car. What would you say in this example?
I would, for most of my clients, lean towards the car because one, that interest rate is pretty terrible and we're starting to get kind of close to like long turns in the market. Also think about cash flow. Like if someone is on average paying over $700 a month, well, the faster you get that back in your cash flow, that's money that you can take and throw back in the market.
Yeah, that's a big, big car payment. So also, interestingly, used car interest rates are even higher. They're at 11.93%, according to Experian. And my hypothesis about that is they don't have as many like brand new like dealer sales, if that makes sense, or like financing deals. Because for brand new cars, there's always some kind of deal, like 0% for 12 months or 0% for 18 months or something like that. So sometimes that can make like probably the weighted average like interest rate lower, but also folks looking at used cars are looking probably for a lower priced car, something not like right off the lot that's the most expensive. Just thought that was really interesting because that's a big difference between new and used from an interest rate perspective.
Yeah. And I thought, I don't know if you noticed this during like the pandemic, because I had to buy a car during the pandemic. I had to get a van because I was pregnant. So used cars cost pretty much the same as new at that time. So we kind of think, oh yeah, I'll buy a used car. It's cheaper. That wasn't the case during the pandemic. Like for a lot of people, it made sense just to like spend an extra couple thousand and get the new car, which was really bizarre. I don't know if it's like that still, not in the market, but.
Yeah, I think it's calmed down a bit. So let's talk about like who should be buying a car and who should be leasing. And I think leasing has gotten a bad rap from like maybe other financial talking heads out there because leasing a car is like renting. Like you're always going to have a car payment. You're never going to own the car. But for some people, it might make sense. Us being like comprehensive planners, like fiduciary financial planners, like we have to be thinking about big picture, what's best for the client, what's best for their situation. And let's say someone makes great income, they're saving, they're investing, they're doing all the right things, and they like to drive nice, newer cars. That's what they enjoy. Maybe they have a job where they need to, like they're a realtor, or they're someone who like drives for work, drives customers to and from places, or like, you know, potential clients, whatever, whatever the reason is. Maybe you just enjoy nice cars. It would not make sense for someone to purchase a new car every couple of years, right? Because you're purchasing, you're buying something, you're maybe putting it on an auto loan, and then you're responsible for all the maintenance costs if you've purchased the car. And then you trade it in, you go and trade it in for a new car. You have to pay like, you know, probably some kind of down payment. You have to start the whole process over again. So in these cases, if you're someone who not churns new cars, I don't know if that's the right word. That sounds negative. But if you're someone who buys a new car or wants a new car every couple of years, you're probably better suited for a lease. And if you are driving this newer car for business purposes, there could be ways to write off that expense. I know you're kind of diving into tax more. What are your thoughts on leasing?
I'm flirting with taxes these days. I will say I am one of those talking heads that in general, I am not a huge fan of leasing. I think that what you described is the kind of the ideal profile of someone who should lease would be someone who has the cash flow and is okay with like, yeah, I like cars. I want to get a new one every few years. I actually do have a client though who owns like 3 or 4 cars outright, which is fine for their situation. They like working on them. I don't know that they're going to buy more cars. they're otherwise in a good financial spot. So I'm like, well, if this is your hobby, then by all means. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think with the leasing, yeah, that I think it really just has to be a hobby for you. With the renting concept, I think that's a really good way to put it, right? You're only responsible for so much, right? You're not going to have as much maintenance costs. You're kind of getting that car in its earlier years when there's less likely something to go wrong. And then you can always get it back to the dealer and then get something new again. So that's one way to keep costs low. And I think we tend to forget about the maintenance costs. So that's another area where leasing can be helpful. There are a lot of like TikTok videos right now about like, you know, tax hacks with leasing, but it does need to be for, and I'm not an expert, so kind of don't quote me on this, but it does need to be for like a bona fide business reason. You can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to like buy this car and lease it. It also depends on your business, right? Like, do you actually have a car that you can and should depreciate versus like leasing? So talk to your tax professional. There could be some hacks there, but in general, probably not the best idea for most people. And don't believe everything that you see on the internet.
Right. Yeah. Tax write-offs, like tax things right now, especially right now, like kind of I think in general, like saving money, of course, is a hot topic. People want to save money and they want to find all these hacks. But yeah, be wary of advice that you're getting online. Hey, that means like listening to this, watching this video. You know, this is general information. This is not specific advice for anybody. Specific advice comes with working with somebody who knows your situation, whether that be a CPA or a financial planner. But going back to auto loan balances, auto loans, it can be a wealth killer if we're not building it into the plan smartly. Like there's the other side of the spectrum where someone will purchase a car and they'll drive it into the ground. They'll drive it until it cannot be driven anymore. That's what I had done with my first car, drove in high school and college through like the first couple years of my job. I literally drove it until the engine was leaking oil and it was going to cost way more to replace or to fix than it would be to just go and purchase a new vehicle.
I think that's a good point because there's a lot of financial, you know, gurus out there, and I'm putting that in quotes, and they're like, well, buy a really cheap clunker. I'm like, that's a wealth killer. You're going to spend so much money. Ask me how I know.
Fixing it.
Sven, my first car, Honda Civic. I name all my cars. It was Sven. I love Sven, but he was a total money pit. We bought, you know, it was really cheap. I think we bought it for like a couple thousand. So that was really cheap. And we spent more than that just repairing him.
Repairs are pretty expensive. So fun little like sneak peek. I'm going to have an episode about like car maintenance, car hacks, or like taking care of your car here in the future with my brother. He's a auto mechanic. He's going to give us all the deets. So that'll be an episode at some point in the future where we'll talk about how we can save on everyday things that we do and that we have to maintain. Maintenance can be expensive. Replacing tires can be expensive. Accident stuff can be expensive. Like I've had to replace my windshield already. I purchased my car back in April of 2022. And I think this has happened twice now. I've hit something that has chipped and then eventually turned into a crack on my windshield. So I had to replace the windshield twice now. It can just be expensive. So owning a car can be expensive. Having that emergency reserve is definitely important, right? We can't preach that enough because just unexpected things happen, like not fun stuff that we want to pay for, but we have to pay for. Any last words on auto balances, auto loans before we move on?
Look at gas mileage when you think about a vehicle purchase.
Yeah, that's true. How much do you drive? And I know like there are some folks that commute an hour to work. So you're really going to want to look at like a vehicle that has like good miles per gallon efficiency versus like a big SUV that gets like 12 to 18 miles to the gallon, because that could be really expensive long term, like filling it up with gas. What did you end up getting?
Yes, this is not sponsored by anyone. I got a Toyota Sienna. Love it. It's really good on gas as far as like minivans go. I kind of narrowed it down to three and I got really lucky with that one. I kind of tell the whole story in a different podcast I did. I was very pregnant when I walked into the dealership. And anyways, so I think it helped me get the car because as a lot of parents probably know, it's very difficult to get a Toyota Sienna. There's a long wait list.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting. I don't know about that van life yet. I just have children, but they just jump in the back of the car now. Don't need car seats yet. All right. So talked about auto loans, how they can be a wealth killer. They could just be pretty expensive, soaking up a lot of your cash flow for the payment and for maintenance. Maybe leasing makes sense for some people, maybe not. Let's talk about comparison. I think comparison, like kind of keeping up with the Joneses, that like saying, I think that is a wealth killer as well. Have you seen instances like with your clients or just in life with folks trying to keep up with the Joneses where it's kind of crushed their financial situation?
All the time. I get that question a lot. Like if I'm working with a specific profession, they're like, well, how much do other people in this like what are they making or what are they spending? How much do they spend on this? Like to gauge like, oh, should I spend more or less? I try to spin it in a positive way. I'm like, well, for example, I work with a lot of physicians. I'm like, well, for savings rates, a lot of physicians need to hit like a 20% savings rate if you want to keep up a similar lifestyle in retirement and actually like retire early. So I try to spin it in a positive way to build those habits, but it can totally be used in a different way. Like, should I buy more house? Am I spending as much as my colleagues on a house, a car, my kids' camp?
I was going to say like a car, going back to the last bullet, a car can be something that not everyone sees your house, right? Like you don't invite all of your colleagues over to your house, but your car, like your colleagues might see you pull up in the car. So like I do see a lot of like keeping up with the Joneses mentality about the car you drive, because, you know, that's in a way a status symbol to people that you don't know, but also people that you do know that you probably wouldn't invite over to your house. And in a weird way, like, people want to feel like they're doing well. And a car can be a way to like tell the world, hey, I'm doing awesome, even if it's all financed. Right. Yeah. So comparison is, this is not a new saying. I've heard it many, many times, but comparison is the thief of joy. It really is, because you're never going to keep up with that next thing. You're just never going to. And it's a really exhausting way to try to feel worthy and important, I guess you could say. So I try to practice a lot of contentment. I wish there was like a word for it. Contentment. There we go. Yeah, there we go. See, good at numbers, not words. But contentment, like practicing that, I think is really important for literally every single person in this world could benefit from like finding happiness and contentment. Not to say that you settle and that you just, you deal with like crappy things in your life. No, not at all. More so like, know when is enough. Like, when are you happy? And is that next thing going to make you happier? Debatable. Like, really think about that. So there's like lots of examples on social media is definitely a like, oh my gosh, that's like gasoline to the fire with comparison, because it's so easy.
You only ever see a snapshot, and people are only really ever putting like their best stuff out there. They're not being vulnerable. Like, hey, here's the photo of me and my husband. We just had a fight.
Right. Or here's like, you know, my destroyed living room because my kids threw all the toys out and I've got to spend all weekend like cleaning up or whatever. Like, no one's going to post those pictures. It is legitimately a highlight reel of your life. So it's all the happy, all the clean, all the good parts of your life. And it's so easy. It's so easy to feel like you're not doing as well as other people by looking at that, because you're only seeing the good. This is not new information. Everybody knows this, but it's worth like repeating. There are some specific like phenomenons I would like to mention on Instagram, social media that or TikTok that are pretty intense when it comes to like comparison and like feeling like you're needing to go purchase something or needing to do something differently. So one of those phenomenons I would call unhinged consumerism. Do you know what that means, or have you seen examples?
Please educate me.
Unhinged consumerism, that I would say is just crazy amounts of purchasing or like overconsumption of products, which could be beauty products, it could be food products, it could be, you know, household items, could be holiday decor, just like overconsumption. And we see this with different things, like Stanley cups, I think, is another like example of overconsumption. Like, how many colors of Stanley cups do you need? I don't know, but it's not 500 or like, you know, 20. I think 20 is a lot just to have the same cup in a different color. And those Stanley cups were not cheap. I know that's kind of dying down now, but it was such a phenomenon like recently. So some other examples of this you probably have seen if you've been on Reels or on TikTok, but restock videos, like restocking groceries or restocking, like there's another one, like guest bathrooms, like restocking with like materials for guests, like toothpaste and like floss and like fun stuff in the guest bathroom. Restocking like your kids' fridges, like snack fridges or whatever. And it's all these like different drinks, different snacks. So I said ice earlier. There's someone online who does these like fancy like ice molds. So she's got probably like, I'm not even kidding, probably like 50 different ice molds, maybe more. And every week she'll like do a video of her like redoing this ice mold and like putting them all in her freezer. And she uses the ice over the course of the week or whatever. But like, do you need that many ice molds? Like, do you need something that looks like a butterfly and a star and a princess?
If it gets you to drink more water, I'm for it.
Yeah. So with a disclaimer that everybody has the right to totally like go for things that they love to do. If this brings that person joy, great. But if you're looking at that thinking like, man, maybe I should have some cool like ice things, like you don't need them. Like, don't make them convince you that you need these things to be happy or to be fulfilled. I don't know. Those are some quick examples of like unhinged consumerism in my mind. Oh, and then I think I mentioned like ASMR clicking. Like, basically it's like on these Reels or on these TikToks, it'll be like just a video of them like restocking the fridge. Like they'll show it before it's pretty empty, and then they'll show them along the video, like restocking everything. And it's very like clicky. Like, I don't know if you can hear anything, but like, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Maybe like ASMR.
Right. There's also like rage baiting. Have you ever heard that? Or do you know what that is?
Not in the context of consumerism.
Yeah. So this, not totally consumerism, but rage baiting is also a way to like get your attention on a video, which attention is currency, right? Online. So if you are kind of fired up about something you just saw, you fell into that rage baiting trap. And it's probably because they are on a platform selling something. If you follow them, or if you find out, you know, you get on their email list or whatever it is, like eventually, like you're going to be sold something. But rage baiting, an example is like, this is an example of like overconsumption. There's another couple accounts where basically they make an exorbitant amount of food, or a huge, like literal, like, do you know what like a big Home Depot bucket looks like? Like one of those big, so like they'll make a coffee in that like thing, you know what I'm talking about? Like basically it's like gallons of coffee, gallons of like creamer, sugar. No, they don't use it. They don't eat it. It's really just like to take the video.
That's so wasteful.
Yes. So it's very wasteful. So again, going back to the massive like overconsumption, and it's meant to like get people fired up. Like what? Like, why would you purchase all those items? And it's pretty much inedible, or it's undrinkable, and you can't save it. Why would you do that? And it's for attention. Again, attention is currency.
This is kind of meta, but maybe the real overconsumption is our social media use.
100%.
That was the real enemy the whole time.
Yeah. Okay. So going off of the rant of like social media comparison traps, because they are traps, I would say. You can apply this to anything. Like if you're comparing yourself to your neighbor who just bought a brand new car, or who just redid their house, or just bought a bunch of new furniture, like comparison is really hard to keep up with if that's not the place of life that you're in, or if that wasn't even a goal of yours to begin with. If redoing your whole house to match, like there's another like trend, the sad beige mom trend.
Oh, gosh. That I know.
If you're repainting your whole house beige and you're redoing all of your upholstery beige and like whatever, this is just silly. If that makes you happy, go for it. But like if you're being influenced when like you had no intention of making any of these changes, like we just have to pause and think about these things. Like, is this something that I want to do? Of course, like we want inspiration and we want help with like design ideas and thing, or like, you know, whatever you're doing in your life, you want some inspiration. But the point is really just to make sure that you're being true to what your goals are, and you're not allowing like other external things to make you feel like you need to be doing something differently or more or something sooner than you originally would have to like take you off course of your goals. Because that's what it comes down to, is like if comparison is making you not be able to afford saving as much as you need to save to, you know, really get to where you want to be, like being able to work 4 days a week or being able to retire at 55. Like if it's taking away from those bigger goals of yours, that's where it becomes problematic. Otherwise, it's fun. It's interesting.
I like the whole Marie Kondo, does it spark joy? Maybe it doesn't spark joy to have everything beige, or the new one is grayish, where it's like, there's like grayish, a tint of gray, grayish, the grayish trend. Maybe it doesn't spark joy for you. You have to live in that house after you do it.
Mm-hmm. So comparison, theft of wealth, I would say, if we're not grounded in our financial goals, if we're not committed to what we're trying to do, don't get influenced to your detriment. So next up, fourth on the list of a wealth killer, inflation.
This is a big one. You see a lot of people who have like considerable cash, and they, for, you know, lack of a better way of putting it, they just like put it under their mattress, or maybe they keep it in like a non-interest bearing account. This is a wealth killer because you want your funds and everything that you've been working towards to actually keep up and be usable in the future.
Mm-hmm. On average, like what would be the cost of like burying money in the backyard or putting money under a mattress? Like what is the cost to you per year, you would think?
I bet you we could calculate it. You just need to pull up a financial calculator. We'll run through an example.
While you do that, I will remind, we did mention this on a prior podcast at some point, but I did have a client whose dad legitimately buried money in the backyard, like a big settlement that they got 10, 15 years ago or something, probably so they wouldn't spend it, but it was buried. So it wasn't invested. It wasn't earning anything. It wasn't going, you know, it wasn't keeping up with inflation. So that was a really interesting case.
I have one. We can kind of play with this, but let's say you bury $1,000 in your backyard, right? Mm-hmm. For 10 years. So this is 10 years that you're not investing. It's not growing, right? And I'm going to use 8% as our rate of return of what it could have made in the market, right? Well, diversified portfolio, all that good stuff. So if it had been in the market during those 10 years, that $1,000 would have doubled, more than doubled. It would have been $2,159.
Without contributing to it, right?
Without contributing, just leaving it alone and letting that, you know, do its work.
And what would it be if it was buried?
That's, yeah, it's not doing anything. It's just $1,000. That's it.
Yeah. But it's also like you can't spend like $1,000 10 years ago spends differently than how it spends today, right? Like think about what something cost 10 years ago compared to today. Like it's just inflation really does eat away at money and the ability to purchase the same things over time for the same price. So inflation is definitely a wealth killer. So not investing, I think, is a mistake. Of course, we need emergency savings, boring savings, and a high yield savings account gives us a little bit of oomph to that boring savings. But anything else, like stuff that's for kind of intermediate term goals, long term goals, we should be investing. And we could be very well diversified, make sure that we're doing the right things to grow that money over time, being tax efficient with like tax loss harvesting. That's something that we talk about on a prior episode about like how beneficial tax loss harvesting is in taxable accounts. There's different biases. I think sunk cost fallacy. Like, what is that bias exactly?
Sunk cost fallacy. This is someone who maybe made a mistake or did something that maybe wasn't in their best interest, but they're going to just hold on to it. Well, I've already been doing this. I'm already comfortable with this. I'm afraid to cut my losses. It's someone who's afraid to cut their losses.
Yeah. Afraid of cutting losses, afraid of change. There's also like overconfidence bias when it comes to like another like investing mistake or just life mistake, right? Doesn't have to be just investing or money related.
We see that a lot. Someone who thinks that they can do better than the market. They do a lot of active trading. I guess you kind of know my bias. I'm more of a passive investor, kind of more set it and forget it. Or even how do you pick your investments? How do you allocate them efficiently across all of your accounts? A lot of people don't know how to do that. And then I had a client who did this once, but they're contributing to their accounts and they forget to invest it. So it's still just sitting in cash. I put my money in my Roth, right? But you have to invest it. You can't just leave it there. So we have a number of people do that. We have people who do tax loss harvesting and they do it wrong. And so then they have a wash sale, right? They're trying to take a loss on something that they can't take. And so, you know, not the biggest thing in the world. You can still add it to the basis in your investments, but do you know what basis is? Like even those types of terms, a lot of people don't know. So yeah, lots of mistakes with investing that can end up costing you a lot in the future, because here's the thing. This sounds like a good thing, right? Longevity risk. What it means is people are living longer and that's fantastic. We have a lot of medical advances now. That means we're maybe going to push that, you know, average age of death higher. I know women live longer, especially ladies. We got to get our bread. So we need our money to live with us too. We're going to outlive our husbands. We need to find something to do, right? So let's make sure that we're kind of investing in a way that's going to keep up with our length of life.
Yeah. Length of life, keep up with inflation. And yeah, not allow inflation or these mistakes, investing mistakes, to be wealth killers. And we can't end this episode without talking about another wealth killer that everyone listening probably has, which is student loans, right? That's probably like what a lot of people think is a wealth killer, student loan debt.
I just looked it up, Megan. Guess how much? I'm going to have you guess in trillions. How much outstanding student loan debt is there?
Is it 1.45 trillion?
It is 1.75.
Oh, okay. It got higher.
It is even worse. Yep.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So yeah, student loans, are they a wealth killer? Debatable. Like, of course, you needed the student loans to get through school. You couldn't pay out of pocket for it. That was the way that you could become a veterinarian, a doctor, a dentist, a chiro, like whatever your profession is now. But it is an additional tax on your income. So that tax is not going towards building your wealth. It did get you the opportunity, though, to make the income that you're making today. So we could talk out of both sides of our mouth for student loans, I feel like. But I think really the wealth killer with student loans is not having the right student loan plan in place, you know, there are different ways we can tackle student loans, and we really need to come down to the best way to maximize your student loan plan to fit within the rest of your financial plan. But yeah, what else would you say about student loans?
I would say even just on the front end, like trying to be strategic about where you go to school if you do know what you want to study, right? Like for something like nursing, do you need to go to the most expensive school? Debatable. You know, maybe you can start off at like a community college, get your prereqs out of the way, and then transfer somewhere else. That's a way that you can be strategic and making sure that you don't borrow private loans over federal loans first, right? Get those federal loans. There's a lot more forgiveness opportunities. So even just on the pre-debt side of the house, kind of thinking through that before you've borrowed the debt.
Yeah. And like folks with kids now, like this is stuff that you could think about too for your kiddos, because there's a lot of high school programs now that have, I think in my state, it's called dual enrollment, where high schoolers are finishing out like their senior year of high school, but they're also enrolled in kind of the earlier classes, like the, what's it called? Like the general classes of college, the prerequisites to get those out of the way. And it is cheaper, if not free, to do that dual enrollment program. And that means you pay less tuition later for the kiddos to finish undergrad. So that's something to look at.
AP classes too. Some schools require like a score of 5. Some will let you get with a 4. But if you score high enough, those can convert to college credits as well.
Yep. So student loans, are they a wealth killer? They can be if we don't have the right plan, if we're not thinking about education savings for kiddos, part of a financial plan. That's something that we discuss a lot about, you know, with kids in the future, like, should we be saving for education? Should we be saving more for retirement? What's the balance? But most importantly, like taking care of you, taking care of your student loan plan, your retirement plan, to avoid like all of these wealth killers at the end of the day, like to start to avoid and minimize these wealth killers as much as we can to get you on track for your financial goals.
Yeah. During the pandemic, we saw a lot of people refinance their student loans because rates were really low, but that was a huge mistake because these are folks who probably should have gone for forgiveness instead. And once the loans are private, that's it. You can't revert them back.
Yeah. So having the right plan in place is really important, because what your neighbor did or what your colleague did or your classmate did might not be the best plan for you specifically based on your set of details and facts. So student loan planner, we do offer one-on-one consultations if you need help with this stuff. We got a bunch of free content on our website as well if you need some help with this. Calculators, blog content, things like that that can help you really move the needle on your plan to get that first step, I feel like, of going on your financial plan, like taking care of the student loans. Thanks for joining me today, Sim, to chat wealth killers and how we can avoid them, just like factually what we need to be watching out for, that kind of thing. This has been pretty fun.
I always am down to chat, and I wish everyone would take care of themselves first, and you are worthy regardless of what your net worth says.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in today. Catch us on the next Friday episode and have a great weekend.
This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.